short time ago, an American airplane dropped one bomb on Hiroshima.
Ich bin ein Berliner.
Mr. Gorbachev, tear down this.
American people, I think, is good people. They have not to charge with the guilt.
All right. Welcome back to the Cold War.
Hell yeah.
Episode 257,
wow.
I believe.
I'm impressed with us.
How are you, my little furry friend?
Oh, yeah. I'm furry. I'm your friend. Hitting all cylinders here. What about you?
And little.
Little.
Yeah. I'm great.
Good.
Right.
You want to show him your move? Your Wing Chun? Yeah. No.
I don't think it would translate.
You're probably
no,
right.
No.
Let's just say that Cam is on the cutting edge of, well, a lot of things.
Yeah.
A lot of things, really. Certainly
yeah,
self-defense.
Yeah, yeah.
Anyway, speaking of self-defense, go ahead.
Self-defense? Yeah. So, at the end of our last episode.
Yeah.
Avril Harriman. President Truman's go-to guy.
Problem solver, fixer.
And,
yeah.
A fucker of women.
who is it?
Terminated his mission to Tehran. It was a complete failure.
Yes.
He had gone there hoping to force Mossadegh, Moss the boss, and the British into some sort of compromise.
Right.
Neither side really gives a fuck what the Americans want or think at this juncture.
Yeah.
And as I said at the end of the last episode, before he left, Harriman met with the Shah and said,
suggested, you know,
it might be time to revisit the question of getting rid of your democratically elected, beloved prime minister, beloved by the people.
Right. Right.
Not that we would do that ever. Not that we would interfere with the democracy of another country, because we are the United States of America and we love democracy.
Freedom loving.
That said,
yeah.
There are limits to everything.
Exactly.
The British, though, not so much of lovers of democracy. Decided to intensify their attempts to get rid of Mossadegh. They start pulling strings behind the scenes.
Right.
Mossadegh, of course, the British are meeting with, you know, various parliamentarians and senior people in Tehran and politicians and the Shah.
Community
and
leaders.
Generals.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
Saying, we want to get rid of this cunt. Can you help me do it? And, of course, Mossadegh finds out about this almost immediately.
Right.
On September the 6th,
right?
I don't know, whatever year we're up to, is it 51 or 52?
51? Yeah.
He makes a speech to the Senate condemning foreign interference in the affairs of Iran and warned that if the British didn't stop plotting against him, he would expel immediately all of the remaining British citizens in Abadan,
right,
where the oil refinery was. Now, why he hadn't already done that,
right,
I'm not sure.
Well, my thinking was, let me kick out a lot of them, but let me keep some here in case I need to make another political gesture by kicking out some more. That's a total guess on my part. But he also knows that there's, unfortunately, not anyone in Iran who can run this place. So if he can work something out with the British, there'll be a team on the ground. But yeah, there's still some there. And I think maybe they're just what would you call them? Not hostages, that's too rush, but pawns in a much larger game.
Yeah, you're right. I mean, as we'll see over the course of this episode, the Iranians are going to find it extremely difficult to find people to run their oil refinery operations, and the British do their utmost to make it as difficult as possible.
Yes.
Now, Clement Attlee, the Prime Minister of the United Kingdom at the time, responded to Mossadegh's speech by ordering the Royal Navy to strengthen the flotilla of warships that he had sitting just off of Iran's coast. Gunboat diplomacy at its finest. And you know, again, I'm going to bang on about this a lot, as I typically do. This we're not talking about 1820 here,
right?
We're talking about 1951 after World War II.
Yeah,
after the signing of the Atlantic Charter, which supposedly declared the right to self-determination for all peoples of the world. After the creation of the United Nations, which was meant to protect the right to self-determination for all peoples.
Right.
The British got a flotilla of warships. This is, you know, after Winston Churchill has stood up in the United States and talked about the dangers of the Soviet Union and the Iron Curtain and
them enforcing
their will upon the poor people
of
Europe.
Oppression, yes. Disgusting.
The British, the Labour British Prime Minister,
right?
Not even a Conservative, the Labour British Prime Minister has got a flotilla of warships off the coast of Iran because they have the temerity to say Iranian oil is for Iranian people.
If I could, real quick, 2 points. One, you're right. This is not the 1800s anymore. These ships can fire very big shells miles inland. I mean, they can hit some things. They can do some serious damage. This is, you know, this is not just some feeble cannon that can just wreck the coast immediately. And also, and you make a good point about after the Atlantic Charter, if World War I was the war to end all wars, and that clearly didn't work, and then World War II being about even the little bird must be free to sing, as long as they sing the tune that I want. So obviously, even though we've had two massive wars, millions dead, nothing's changed. It's still the haves can tell the have-nots what to do, or we will fire upon you. Nothing has changed, except for the optics of it, if you will.
And the great irony, of course, of this flotilla of warships is, what are the warships running on?
Over there, that oil. See, it's in that storage. I'm pointing at. Yeah, you're right. And wasn't the British Royal Navy getting, how should I put this delicately, a significant discount from the company after it pulled the oil out of the Persian sands? I'm going to leave that right there.
Hmm. Iran is being threatened by their own oil.
Yes, that's tricky.
Now, for the previous year, the British had been toying with the idea of landing troops in Iran.
Yes.
To secure the refinery and the oil fields. Mm-hmm. In the autumn of 1950, the British ambassador had told American officials that the dispatch of a small UK force to southern Iran would have a, quote, steadying and not a provocative influence.
Mm-mm. That sounds right.
Listen. Yeah. You know, what we have learned in our years as a colonial power is you got to treat the darkies like you treat your woman.
Right.
With a firm hand.
Right. And a good kick.
And your children.
Right.
Firm hand, good kick. Yep. Punch in the eye, punch in the teeth every now and again. Mm-hmm. They don't mind it. They appreciate it.
Between you and me, they kind of like
it. They will thank you.
Right.
You know,
down the road. Yes.
Yeah. Have you watched the most recent season of Fargo?
No, I have not. No.
Highly recommend it. Really good, good season. As opposed to the previous season, which I didn't like and gave up on, this season, really good. John Hamm plays John Hamm plays this right-wing, Trumpy, libertarian sheriff.
Oh, God.
Sort of Fargo, North Dakota-y kind of part of, you know, Minnesota, North Dakota, wherever it is.
Right.
And, you know, he treats his women and children with a firm hand because the Bible tells him so. And he's building his little private militia down there.
Oh, God, because God. Yeah.
Because God wants him to, And he does a great job. Best thing John Hamm's done since Mad Men, I think. And Juno Temple, who people may know as sort of the girlfriend of a soccer player from Ted Lasso, British actress.
Right.
She is the main star.
I love her.
Playing one of his ex-wives who ran away.
Oh, my
and he's trying to have her kidnapped.
Yeah.
And she's a badass in this. Really great performance from her, from everybody involved. Yeah, right. Really, really good season.
Cool.
Anyway, so the British wanted to treat Iran like John Hamm's character treats his women. Just with a firm hand, punch them around a bit, and you know that's how they know that they're loved,
right? And really, that's the only way they know that they're crossing the line. If you don't show them, I think it's called painful instruction. Something like, I'm not sure exact phrasing, but no. What is the mindset? Look, we'll send in a small force. Yeah, we'll bust a couple of skulls, but I actually think this. I think this will help the overall situation. It won't make it any worse. I cannot see how this would make it any worse. That is the widest line of thinking that I have ever heard.
And around about the same time, Sir George Bolton,
yes,
Michael Bolton's father, the executive director of the Bank of England,
yeah,
passed on a report from his Middle East advisor to the Foreign Office.
Right.
Which said that the possibility of direct intervention by taking over the oil fields by force should be considered.
Yeah, so this is April of 1951. And again, so just think of it this way. The Foreign Office is the nexus for all of these, for all of these reports. So all these reports are coming in, how should I put this, unbidden? It's not like someone asked the Bank of England to check with their Middle East advisor to then write up a report. So, but they're all saying the same thing. You know what? It's gotten to a point where violence is the only solution that we can possibly see, but in a good way, in a good way. So, but the Foreign Office is going to be flooded with a lot of things that they like to hear. The point is, the Prime Minister is not as keen as Bolton or Morrison is.
The Minister of Defense of the United Kingdom at the time was a guy called Emmanuel Shinwell, a.k.a. Yes. Manny Shinwell, a.k.a. Baron Shinwell.
Right.
And I did a deep dive on this guy over the course of the week. Fascinating character, Manny Shinwell.
Yeah.
He's best remembered in the UK apparently as the Minister of Fuel and Power,
right,
in the Clement Attlee government, who nationalized coal mining in 1946.
But let me just add this one sentence as you go on. When he was negotiating with the coal miners and they got really, really ugly, he said to the newspaper, the middle class, and this is, he's talking about the coal miners, because at the time, you know, they were making, you know, decent money, trying to make more. He says, the middle class is not worth a tinker's cuss. So on one hand, he's nationalizing it. On the other hand, he's like, I could not care less about you people. And you're Britons. We haven't even talked about the darkies yet. I mean, this is what he's saying about his own countrymen. I just wanted to throw that in there. And did you read the part in 1938 when he punched a prime minister in the face on the floor of the House of Commons? Knocked his ass down. I don't know if you came across that.
A prime minister, that would have been
A member of parliament.
Chamberlain, wouldn't it?
Member of parliament.
Oh, just an MP.
I got it backwards. MP. He knocked his ass down because the guy said, go back to Poland. And as you know, Shinwell is, he has Jewish parents on both sides.
Shinwell.
He took that not too kindly.
Well, that's one of the fascinating things about this guy. He was born to poor Jewish parents.
Yes.
And ended up becoming a member of the House of Lords.
Not
Baron
bad.
Shinwell. I mean, yeah, a crazy, crazy life. Lived till, I think he died at 101 in 1986.
Yeah.
But the second part of the story about nationalizing coal mining and then the oil industry in 1946 and 1947,
right,
he said, there will be no fuel crisis. They in 1947, Britain had an extremely severe winter, serious coal shortage, heating shortage. He said, there will be no fuel crisis. I am Minister of Fuel and Power, and I ought to know. And then they had a massive fuel crisis. And
I said, no,
he got sacked as the Minister for Fuel and Power. He also presided over the nationalization of electricity in 1947.
So
he got sacked. But, you know, again, the irony here, nationalized,
yes,
the British coal, oil, electricity industries.
Yes.
But when Iran tries to do it, he told cabinet that tolerating nationalization of Anglo-Iranian would set a terrible precedent. and that they must be prepared to show that their tail could not be twisted interminably.
Oh, don't we can't look bad or weak. We cannot look weak.
Listen.
Yeah.
Because we like do what we say, not what we do, colonial occupied countries.
Yeah. Oh,
barbarians, darkies.
There's one more.
We're white.
That's right.
You don't like white people white can do right. things.
I'm sorry.
That, you know, darkies
should not.
I'm not sure. They, what would they have called Persians? I mean, there was sand monkeys, probably.
I don't know when that came.
What racially disparaging term would the British have called
off-white.
Persians in 1951?
Yeah, mocha. I don't know. Anyway, but there is one more
mocha
wrinkle.
Joe?
Yes, there is one more wrinkle to this. First of all, going back to his childhood, he pretty much educated himself in a local library. So again, a form of socialism where there's a repository. What's the word I'm looking for? A building full of books that he doesn't have to pay for. He got his education started that way. But in 1950, 1 year before all the stuff we're talking about, he got demoted. And so he still had a position with the Ministry of Defense, but he was no longer a cabinet member. And so when 1951's coming around and there's all this drama, one of the reasons that he's so gung-ho, besides being extremely white and extremely British, is he wants a promotion. He wants back into the cabinet. So he's doing the right thing for his country, but he's also doing the right thing for himself.
But he's Jewish, right? So son of a Jewish tailor. He's also, I mean, as we know, the Jews, particularly coming out of Europe, then are sort of half Semitic, half European in terms of their genetic heritage. So, I mean, his, I guess, racism towards the people in Persia may be doubly surprising.
Ooh,
he's not a fully sort of white Brit. He was in the shadow cabinet in opposition until he stepped down in 1955. Then he was a senior backbencher until 1970 in his mid-80s. Then he became a member of the House of Lords, stayed at that until shortly before his death, again at 101 in 1986.
Wow.
In the 80s, during the build-up to the Falklands War, he apparently stood up in the House of Lords and yelled, "Let's get on with the war and damn the expense." He's in his late 90s at the time.
He still wants to punch somebody in the face. Oh, my God. But we have to remember the
90s. Go ahead. I read all these obits for him when he died, and the British loved him. Like, he was like this massive character with a massively long career. But when I was reading those, I stumbled across this other story. This is in the Baltimore Sun.
Right.
8th of September, 1947. They had a thing on him from 1947, but then they had this other story next to it, which just took my attention. Cries of Heil Hitler sounded in slum area streets of London.
Yeah.
Mounted police were out for the first time tonight in East London to break up possible clashes between communists and the British League of Ex-Servicemen, said to include former members of Sir Oswald Mosley's British Union of Fascists.
Mm-hmm.
Cries of Heil Hitler sounded in the grimy streets of London's slum districts today while the British press swung into a campaign against an incipient fascist movement.
Damn.
Demands for decisive government action against fascist groups, fascist street orators, and publications smacking of the Hitler ideology came from left-wing and middle-of-the-road journals and had the formal support of the powerful Trades Union Congress, an alliance of 8 million working people. Press commentators took the view that the movement had been given impetus by Britain's economic crisis and her troubles with the Jewish underground in Palestine.
Mm.
Most of the fascist street speakers are violently anti-Semitic. I was just fascinated that here we are in 1947, 2 years after the end of World War II.
Yes.
We talked in our last episodes about one of the representatives that Attlee sent to Tehran, who was a very proud fascist.
Yes.
You've got London.
Bomb, right?
Just been bombed by the Nazis a couple of years earlier.
Yes.
You've got people walking the streets of London saying Heil Hitler and, you know, giving speeches and promoting fascism, Nazism. fascinating. And, you know, it kind of reminds me, on the Bullshit Filter last week in your absence, Tony Kynaston and I talked about Tucker Carlson's interview with Putin. And of course, Putin talks a lot about the denazification of Ukraine. And as we've talked about on the Bullshit Filter before, yeah, that gets laughed at. And even Tucker Carlson, who was later interviewed by Lex Fridman, I'm halfway through listening to that. Mm-hmm. He goes, Lex asked him, what did you think when he talked about denazification? And Tucker said, I didn't understand. It makes no sense. It's the stupidest argument at all. They're playing it down. But as we know, and as I pointed out on the Bullshit Filter,
right,
it's a real thing. I mean, there are neo-Nazi groups in Ukraine, particularly in the Donbass area, and the Western media and Western governments took those very seriously just a few years ago before the 2022 escalation over there, and right. I covered all of that in the show. Mm. So it's sort of surprising that there are fascists, neo-Nazis in Ukraine that have quite a bit of support, as it seems. I mean, not massive right. political support, but enough support that there's a lot of concerns in the West that they could take power. Let's remember that the actual Nazis, Hitler's Nazis, didn't have a lot of support in right. Germany in the early 1930s and then within a couple of years managed to take power, right?
Right.
And to see that in London in 1947 just really blew right. my mind.
Well, let me add another wrinkle to that irony there, because as we've said this a billion times, the UK at this point can barely feed its own people. You know, they've been on rations. I think they're going to be on whatever it's called until like the 60s or something like that. So the point is there's not enough food to go around. The reason that there is not is because Britain has lost its empire because of the war and the effects of the war and what happened after the war, which was started in this particular case by Hitler. So again, there's a lot of irony here. There's a lot of uneducated people here. And if they think going to the far right is going to fix their problems, they're insane. But yeah, but these people, the people that are looking down at them are just as racist as they are. And they're willing to ignore an entire country's right to their own resources under their soil. And it's not ever going to stop. And when we are done with this, I've got a beautiful revenge story about Foreign Minister Morrison after this is all over with.
Oh, okay. The other reason Britain was broke after World War II, of course, is that Americans demanded they pay them back all the money that they loaned to them in World War I and World War II. Preferably
gold. We'll take gold. Thank you. Thank you very much.
Yeah, yeah. If people are starving, that sounds like a you problem. Yeah. Just give me my fucking money. Yeah. Back to Shinwell.
Yes.
I made this point before, but this is the same United Kingdom that's accusing the Soviets of interfering in other countries' affairs.
How dare you?
Meanwhile, they're like, fuck it, let's just invade Iran and tell them to leave us alone. Yeah. Anglo-Iranian officials sent a memorandum to the Foreign Office that predicted that if the British landed troops in Iran, the Persians would probably give up immediately.
Yeah.
And then the company could import thousands of colored men from East Africa to do the labor that Iranians might refuse to perform.
Did he have they were to like, say listen, color?
Do you remember slavery? Those were the good old days, weren't they?
Love it.
Listen.
Jerry, love
it. Let's bring it back. Bring slavery back again. Make England great again.
So
fuck. What the actual fuck is wrong with the British? Seriously. I'm just going to throw this out here right now. What, to our British listeners, we love you.
Yes.
But seriously, what the fuck is wrong with you?
Get your dad on the phone or on the Zoom, whatever. No, but I love this. So they send, again, this memo goes to the Foreign Office because the Foreign Office is pushing for war in the form of Herbert Morrison, I believe. So the point is we'll send guns down there. We'll crack a couple skulls. They'll back down. We'll ship over a bunch of darkies from East Africa. All are good. Everything's fine. I do not – it's like – You know that's how it's going to. You know it's going to play out perfectly the way you want it to. Starting a war, no matter how small, is like opening Pandora's box. You make plans, you implement the plans go to shit, and you make new plans, rinse and repeat. That's what happens with war. And so the fact that they think they can just end this with a quick is beyond me. But like you said, this went on for over a year. The Iranians have been bitching and fighting back for over 100 years. They're not going to stop anytime soon. They are truly motivated and they're united like never before.
There was this, in May 1951, 2 months before Harriman arrived in Iran, the British had built plans for the invasion and occupation of Iran.
Right.
The first plan was called Operation Buccaneer or Plan Y.
I like Buccaneer. Go ahead. Sorry.
It involved 70,000 troops for a seaborne and air assault.
Yes.
On the refinery and the oil fields of Iran.
Yeah.
Then they had another plan, Operation Midget.
Sure.
You'd like that. Yeah, yeah. You'd love that one. Aimed at, and apparently the great thing about this plan was they were just going to send in 50,000 midgets into Iran.
Right. Yeah, not stacked on each other's shoulders.
It was also called Operation Oompa Loompa. They were going to send them in.
Singing while they went in. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah. Oompa Loompa diddly doo, I've got a brand new plan for you. Oompa Doompa diddly dee, if you are wise, you'll listen to me.
What do you get, pow?
What do you call an oil field?
That's mine.
That's that's our next film.
Yeah.
No. We're going to do that. Operation Oompa Loompa.
But think about it. They were going to send in literally.
Well, Willy Wonka.
Yes.
Willy Wonka.
He would be in charge, right?
Little known fact, yeah. Willy Wonka was was hired by Foreign Minister Morrison.
That sounds right.
Develop Operation Oompa Loompa. They were going to drop magical candies all across Iran. And when people were chewing the everlasting gobstoppers, the Oompa Loompas would sneak, have a seaborne landing of Oompa Loompas that would infiltrate. And did you see, you probably haven't seen the latest Willy Wonka film?
No, I haven't. That
came out a little while ago?
Right.
You've probably seen have you seen the trailer at least?
Yes, yes.
There's this great scene in the film where Hugh Grant as an Oompa Loompa is sneaking into Willy Wonka's bedroom and stealing his candy.
Oh my god!
And Willy Wonka sets up a trap and captures him, and then asks him to explain why he's doing it. And then Oompa Loompa starts to break into a song.
God.
And Willy Wonka's like, no, don't sing. He's like, sorry, once I start, I can't stop. It's an Oompa Loompa thing.
It's a union rule.
I got to do a song. Yeah. It was a great film. We really enjoyed it.
The part that most people don't know, because this gets buried in the history books, is Willy Wonka told Herbert Morrison, look, in a couple of seconds, some of these Oompa Loompas are going to come in, but they're special. They're commandos. Don't look them in the eye. Just they're going to sneak in. They're scary. They're only 2 foot, two and a half feet, but they're pretty scary. So those are the commandos we're going to send in first. All right. Operation Nudge.
Operation Oompa Loompa.
Yeah. No, but seriously. So they were going to send in a massive force to take and hold the refinery and the oil fields, not all of them, just the oil fields that they had got in the contract. So the point is there was going to be a massive occupation force right in the middle of this country where it's, their most valuable resource. Now let's just scale it back. We'll just scale it back. We'll just take over the refinery and maybe we'll do it for a couple of weeks. Maybe we'll hold it indefinitely. Oh my God, I got an idea. Why don't we hold the refinery? We'll bring oil from other parts of the world. We'll refine it there, then ship it home. So that way they have nothing to bitch about. Whereas you and I know Mossadegh's going to go, bitch, that refinery is ours. We paid for it in blood, helping you build it and helping you run it. It's bullshit. But again, all they can see, because, they've got a hammer, all they can see is nails. They just want to whack this until everybody quits bitching.
The military planners behind Operation Oompa Loompa not only believed that it would ensure oil supply to Britain,
damn right,
but would, and keeping in mind, you know, this is coming off the back of this massive power shortage that they had in the 1947. So, you know, access to coal and oil and heating and all this kind of stuff is big. They're thinking about the safety and comfort of the British people.
Absolutely.
And British industry. But they also believed it would ignite patriotic sentiment. The first Lord of the Admiralty at the time, a guy called Lord Fraser, said a bold military strike would dispel Britain's dumps and doldrums and prove that it would not tolerate being pushed around by Persian pipsqueaks.
I love that.
And love that. To which they said, well, you're going to send in Oompa Loompas to fight the pipsqueaks, really?
This is getting complicated. Real quick, but the point is, so
you got to love his alliteration though. Yes. Dumps and doldrums being pushed around by Persian pipsqueaks. Lord Fraser loved nothing more than alliteration in his speeches. Loved it. Would spend hours coming up. He's like Persian pansies, Persian hoofters, Persian palindromes, pipsqueaks. I need a P word.
Yeah, but again, I do not get this. So one, we will get the oil, and two, it's been a while since we cracked some skulls, you know, especially colored skulls, you know what I'm saying? So the flags will be waving, people will be cheering. Once again, this is a two-for-one deal. You don't pass that up.
And, you know, and taking a serious note for a second, unlike us, I mean, that rationale when considering foreign, wars, I think is true in many countries around the world today. I mean, when America decides to get involved in a war, even via a proxy like Ukraine, you must see a massive sort of boost in patriotic fervor in the United States. You know, we're standing up for Zelensky and Ukraine, and we're fighting the evil Russians, and hurrah for America and all that kind of stuff. Like, I'm sure you get that vibe over there.
Oh, not only that, but you've got all the Ukrainian flag stickers on the back of everybody's car. You're supporting the cause. You feel good. Honk if you know, whatever. So, yeah, Americans, and I'm sure this is true of a lot of countries, but Americans are quite fond of war, especially when it's not fought over here. We're big fans.
Yeah. So, like, you know, Britain, obviously, is part of that. But the Americans, when Truman's administration got wind of the British plans for setting in an invasion force, they actually talked them out of it.
Yeah.
The American media were strongly against the idea of British intervention, referring to it as Britain's reliance on 19th century threats.
Damn.
The media suggested that a British invasion, the US media, this is, a British invasion of Iran might bring a quick outbreak of World War III and stir up rebellions against Western foreigners in other places in Southern Asia.
Oh, yeah.
Now, you know, I inherently don't think the Americans at the time really cared about the Iranians.
No.
You know, as we've talked about before, there's probably a whole bunch of reasons why the Americans are trying to avoid the British having a military intervention in Iran.
Mm-hmm.
Partly, as we've explained, you know, the CIA's view at the time was that it might encourage the Soviets to, you know, get involved, and then that could start a major global conflict.
Right.
But also, they're not that keen on enabling the British to remain in control of their colonial assets. And this is definitely one of those.
Right.
Because the stronger Britain is, the more of a battle they can put up against American hegemony. I mean,
we don't
like it.
That.
I mean, even though, again, we've said the US and the UK position themselves as friends and allies at the time, really, there was this passing of the torch during World War II, where America was taking its place as the global hegemon, supplanting the 19th century colonial powers with all of their massive global trading blocks. And, you know, you can't have two bullies in the playground.
No.
There can be only one, as Sean Connery declared.
Right. Well, see, and I could care for you tremendously. Good friend, best friend. But at the end of the day, it's always a zero-sum game. I want you to have the best you can be as long as you're number two. And you recognize that I'm number one, then we won't have any problems. And if you think about it, it's 1951. The Cold War is just getting going. You know, the parameters haven't really been set. They can't look into the future and go, I know for a fact that for the next 30, 40, whatever, 50 years, there's not going to be a major crisis. There's not going to be nukes launched. They're still setting the parameters of this tension with the Soviet Union and what they're going to do. And so if Britain does some kind of invasion, does it not allow Soviet Russia, like you said, well, if you can do it, we can do it. If the rules have changed, just let me know so we can start taking over smaller countries. But again, war is always Pandora's box. America does not need that headache. And again, Britain can barely feed their people, and now they want to launch a war. I don't care how small. Wars always cost more than you think.
But again, from the American perspective, though, from, you know, as we've been banging on about for years, wars are nearly always caused by economic issues and economic interests.
Right.
If Britain loses control over Iranian oil, who do they have to buy oil from? Probably American companies that have their oil interests in Saudi Arabia and other places. So if Britain loses this, good for America, right? Good for American oil companies, good for American economic interests, good for America's evolving position as the global hegemon, just good in every way. It's just all good for America if Britain loses their oil interests in Iran, and many levels of not good if they get involved in some sort of military operation, which could bring in the Soviets and could just, you know, cause problems for the West in a variety of different ways. And, you know, they'll probably fuck it up because they're the British and America is going to have to get involved in bailing them out again.
For the third.
After World War One and World War Two, we're going to have to come and, you know, loan you money. Because you already can't pay us back the money we fucking loaned you.
That's what I was going to say. You want more money to go
fight another fucking war? Yeah.
If this doesn't work out for Britain and they have to, whatever degree, buy American oil, America will be like, we will be happy to sell you oil as long as you keep making those war payments. I'd hate to think, I don't even want to think about what would happen if you couldn't make those. It would just be another, hammer that the Americans...
Send Oompa Loompas into your country.
And you don't want, especially the commandos, you do not want that.
All right. I think that's the end of this episode. We'll be back next time with what happens next.
An iron curtain has descended across the continent.
Military buildup on the island of Cuba. The purpose of these bases can be none other than to provide a nuclear strike capability against the Western Hemisphere.